On the back of your, in the middle of your sheets, just some things that we didn't cover. You might wonder what the triangle, the stick insect, and the curve is all about. So very quickly, three common constraints to growth. The triangle, the three often practical issues that constrain growth. One is finance. Big issue. Hybels has a saying, you know, how much ministry do you get for $10,000? You get $10,000 worth of ministry. Where you put your resources is often where you center your fruit, and you know as a church grows, there's so much you could do. The biggest constraint is financial. It's a huge issue as a church grows. If you want to change something like a facility, which is the next big constraint, the noughts on the end of the figure are frightening. Church near us, NFI Church, about 400, have just bought a factory unit, cost them £3 million. They raised £1 million from within the church. They borrowed £1 million at 5%, and they've got another £1 million to raise. That is a big ask. It's a big ask. You're paying £50,000 interest. How long is that going to... That's a big ask, isn't it? But they're constrained by their facility. They're in a school. They thought this is the only way forward. You imagine being in a church that needs to go to a facility that can seat 1,600. What's that going to cost? 5 million? 7 million? Now, you might just have a couple of multimillionaires who bail it all out, but you might not. Big problem. And the other constraint is people. You're getting the right people on the bus. And you know the whole kind of Gary Collins stuff, good to great, talks about getting the right people on the bus. The difficulty is this, that somebody who was on the right seat when you were 100 is in the wrong seat when you're 400, and to move them is quite difficult. So the woman that plays, who you're really grateful for, as she ages, the congregation gets younger, they want it louder, faster, better, and she can't play, you know, Stuart Townend rhythms, but she loves, you know, that's a huge... And how do you not break her heart? It's hard. Now, you could say, well, you teach her the gospel and all right, but, you know, yes, you do, but it's still hard. And as you know, one of the great fears of people of my age is that we're going to just be moved sideways and all that we've done is going to be forgotten and we won't count. So how do you keep that not happening? But you need to get the right people on the bus. That's a real challenge. So that's one area of constraint. You may need to work at that. It sounds awful. It sounds awful. And I know it sounds very ungodly. But if you've got enough of that, those other two can normally be sorted in a bigger church, generally. Now, I know you can hire in somebody who can be an absolute nightmare. So don't get me wrong on that. But generally speaking, as a senior pastor, as you get older, you have to learn how to raise large sums of money. Hybels, he said, the biggest challenge ever in my ministry is to raise huge sums of money to take the church forward. That's my biggest challenge as a pastor teacher of a church of now, what, nearly 30,000 people. That's scary, isn't it? Because I'm not good at raising money. I can preach on giving and the rest of it, but to actually see large sums. Now, some of you may have a gift at doing that, but that's not taught at college, is it? Is there a course on how senior pastors have to raise large sums of money? No. So you come to it new, and you just might have some friends who are absolutely loaded. And it just might be they say, okay, you can have my Christmas bonus. Here's £100,000. Go and get a gospel worker or two. Can I have your name? No, man. But you might not. And that's a huge problem. Right. The other one, people. The stick insect is one of us. And this issue. I just talked about it to the larger group. It's the issue of retaining people. Here's some figures. It's from a book called Sticky Church by Larry Osborne. Let me go through them quickly. And you'll have to do the maths on your own figures, okay? I couldn't do it for every size. But here is a church of 250 people that in 10 years wants to grow to 500. Okay, so it would love to see people saved. And I would love to see 500 people in our community who love the Lord Jesus Christ. And it wants to go from two. Now, if it gets loads of visitors, but only 3 out of 10 stay. 7 out of 10 come, go, no, you're not for us. You're losing 7 out of 10 of your visitors. You need to see 834 people come, have a look, because loads of them are going to go. So you're going to have to see at least 83 people a year. Now, that's quite a big ask, year on year on year on year. 83 brand new people. 834. On the other hand, if you keep 7 out of 10, if they say, God, they're so friendly, so welcoming, I'll come back. If you keep 7 out of 10, you only need to see 357 people come to double in 10 years. Now, if your church doubled, that would be really exciting, wouldn't it? I mean, hugely, whatever size you are. If you go from 50 to 100, that is fantastic. If you go from 1,000 to 2,000 in 10 years, poof. And what he's saying is, you know, the issue really is about retaining more than attracting. When you're small, it tends to be more about attracting. Oh, we have 3 people come to the carol service. Isn't that wonderful? You know, fantastic, because nobody's been to a carol service to our church for years. Now we had 3 come and brilliant. Attraction, attraction, attraction. How do we get our name known? How can we make it people want to come? But the big church doesn't have that problem at all. As you get bigger, it's all about retaining. I told some stats to the bigger group. Steve Tibbett in London, he tracked new people. They did a lot of questionnaires. What they found is, if you visited his church, if you had a phone call within a week, half the people came back. No phone call at all or no email at all. They didn't. Only 10% came back. 90% didn't. You got a phone call within a week, 50% came back. A phone call within a day, 80% came back. Just for a phone call. Right, you're going to next hire, Phil Moon, next hire. Somebody's going to make phone calls. Because if somebody makes a phone call and 80% people come back, our church is going to grow. Just from a phone call. You know who's the most important person in your church for visitors? The first person says, hello, lovely to see you. You talk to regularly, if you talk to people, why have you come back to this church? It was friendly. One of the biggest problems you have in your church in retaining people is to teach ordinary Christians to say hello to the new person next to them. I had a whole load of people come to us recently and they said, oh, well, you know what you brought back to your church? I said, well, sorry to disappoint you, Ray, it's definitely not the preaching. You know, the music, it's all right. It was the ordinary Christians said hello week after week after week. We've come back. We thought, oh, maybe I met a really nice person. How have you done it? I said, well, I don't know. You know, but we've tried to encourage ordinary Christians doing ordinary Christian things well. I did a sabbatical 10 years ago. I visited 35 churches. It was a scary experience. I don't think any church in the world says we are the unwelcome. Well, maybe a few exclusive brethren do, you know, but they lock the gates and don't even tell each other. But most churches, no church says we're the unfriendly church. But we found maybe 3 out of that 35 did someone spontaneously say, oh, hi, are you new here today? Only in one church did we ever get an invite back for lunch. Do you know, hospitality is not a gift. It is a grace. You look at what in 1 Peter 4, his lifts, you know, pray for one another, love one another, love covers over a multitude of sins, offer hospitality to one another without grumbling. Then he goes on, and each of you use your gifts, and he goes through some gifts. He puts hospitality as a basic Christian responsibility. On the day of judgment, how does Jesus tell the sheep from the goats? Hospitality. You gave me a cup of cold water. You didn't. You're mine, you're not. But I visited 35 churches. Now, okay, I didn't mind not being asked out. It didn't matter at all. I'm a Christian. I understand. But isn't that amazing? If I was a non-Christian, as the very first time I came to church, and in 30-something churches, nobody said hello. And only in one, somebody said, would you like to come for lunch? Now, that is within the reach of ordinary Christians. We tend to think, oh, we need gifts, we need staff, we need spectacle. No, we don't. We need ordinary Christians doing ordinary Christian things well. Hello, are you new today? Lovely to see you. Who are you? So that means we as leaders need to drill that in deep. It becomes our culture. You know, you do not sit next to somebody you don't know without saying hello, nice to see you. What we found was it's not even the people on the door that the new people notice. It's the people they sit next to. So you can have a wonderfully trained greeting team. But actually what they test is when I sat down in the seat, in the pew, somebody said to me after me, oh, nice to see you. Can I get you a cup of coffee? And that is what brought people back. I mean, it's crazy, isn't it? We put all this stuff on, like, and preach the word and get it accurate and, you know, make sure that the overheads work or, you know, the projector. And all. We do all that, and yet ordinary Christians think it's okay not to talk to strangers. What does Hebrews say? Don't forget to entertain strangers. Because it could be an angel, as Abraham found. In fact, the pre-incarnate Son of God. You imagine sitting next to Jesus and not knowing it. Oops. So, we've got to smarten up our act there. And people, and retaining people, and welcoming people. Stuart Olliott, I know if you know Stuart, very fine preacher from North. There are three quality markers. If they are there, most churches will grow. Quality welcome, quality teaching, quality hospitality. Two of those are in the grasp of every Christian. Quality teaching, quality welcome, quality hospitality. We've got to do a lot more work than we do. How many of you visit abroad? You say, oh, these, you know, going to somebody's house, they'll give you anything. You're going to go and kill a goat. For me, and I feel so embarrassed, or I better eat it. And you see the children hungry looking at you. Some of you have had experience, isn't it? Brits are still, I'm sorry, my house is my own, it's my castle, and you only come in when I let the drawbridge down on my invitation. Schaefer says hospitality is not really being practiced until some youngster is thrown up on your floor. Then you know that's hospitality. You know, we're still miles away from that. But it can start with, can I take you for a McDonald's? It doesn't have to be, you know, does it? Big roast lunch on a Sunday. It could just be, fancy going out for a, you know, McDonald's, Ray, a cup of coffee. It was only a glass of cold water. So it doesn't have to be too grand, but it has to be there. And I think that's something we can work at. Third constraint is this one. Phil Moon and I were at uni together. We both did geography. I don't know about Phil, but I used to hate statistics. We had a statistics class, and Tim Bailey-Smith, you remember? Just a complete nightmare. And goodness me, this is the day before computers, and it's just terrible. But one thing I learned was about this curve. It's called the bell-shaped curve. It's the normal distribution. It's a description of all kinds of things. We're going to come back to this bell-shaped curve in a moment. But in one sense, this is the life cycle of a living thing, isn't it? You know, it's planted, it grows, it thrives, it matures, and gradually it dies off. Living things, all kinds of organisms have a kind of life cycle. Now, churches don't quite... there's all kinds of ways this bell-shaped curve can be distorted, to the left or to the right, can flatten out early and all the rest of it. But if you think of a church growing, certainly a church plant, you start here maybe with 20 or 30 people, that's wonderful, and you grow up to, say, be a medium-sized church, you know, 75, pastors happy, people are happy, and then you grow up to this awkward-sized beast around this 100, you know, Phil and I talked, it's so hard to break through the 200 barrier. If you break through the 200 barrier, you, in principle, have got the blueprint for any amount of growth till you get mega. You know now you've got to organize, you've got to have staff, you've got to have teams, you've got to have small groups, you've got to really work smart. At this size of awkward, a lot of people bellyache. And a lot of people say, oh, Ray, the church felt much more personal, relational, friendly, accessible a few years ago. It's lovely having those new people, but, you know, it used to be so lovely. What's gone wrong? You know what you need to teach them? Look, if you're up here now, 100 and something, 120, 130, and you're growing and it's beginning to get awkward, you need to say to people, you know, the next time we are at that lovely size you loved and I liked and it was wonderful, we'll be on the way down and it won't feel the same at all. It won't. We cannot go backwards. If we do go backwards, it will not be the same thing again. If we ever go back down to 75, 80, it will feel very different. It's just one of those things. We are on a ride, but we don't want to be going down that side. Because once you get down here, it's very hard to do that. And you need to tell people, as the writer does in Ecclesiastes, stop being nostalgic. Stop being nostalgic. Yes, it was a wonderful time. We thank God for it. But you know, there is no rewind button. And next time those numbers dynamics kick in, it will be very tough. So we've got to get used to where we are, and we've got to learn how do we cope with that. And it's a mindset problem in the Christians, isn't it? It is a mindset problem. You need to teach them this, that if God blesses us with conversions, we have to be big enough to say, thank you, Lord. The 120 could have said, you know, all these newcomers since last Pentecost, you know, it was so much better, wasn't it, Peter, when we knew everybody and the Lord was with us? Why did Pentecost have to happen? No. See? But it's a mindset problem.
Can I ask you a question? You mentioned earlier that in your church you planted a few churches.
Yeah.
And now you've sort of kept growing.
Yeah.
Can you give us your thoughts on this? Yeah. To create more, yeah, of these ideal numbers of churches,
yeah,
for growth and for things like that, rather than to
yeah. Okay, observation. Several observations. We had that model. We get up to about 100, 120 we church plant. We did it twice. Great. But two things happen. If you are in a town, Bedford's 100,000 people, we have church planted two other churches. Other churches have church planted other churches. There comes a point where you go, do you know, do we want, I mean, you might say, yes, wonderful to have a church on every street corner. But what begins to kick in is this. You're duplicating phenomenally. You are dragging in every one of those church plants need a very competent teacher preacher. Basically, it's a one man or a small band. Each one of them, it is very relational, but it's costing you £1.5 million over 15 years to keep it like that. Meanwhile, you begin to have pharaohs who don't know Joseph. So what was once a sister church becomes a competitor. And it's hard to kind of keep finding competent leaders. What you tend to do when you church plant from about 120, you give out what your best people, you give out core. You do grow, but you grow fringe. And after a while, you think, we can't keep doing this. We haven't got enough good people to keep giving away. Sometimes those churches, most church planters' horizon, well, who are the people who write books on church planting? Church planters, not church congregants, they don't. The church planters, what do? They're like missionaries, they're only happy when they've got a suitcase. Church planters are only happy when they're thinking about the next church plant. They typically write books about church planting with a horizon between 0 and 7 years. Ed Stelzer, I think, has just written one. He gives church planting stats for the first 4 years. That's like saying, tell me about bringing up children. And you, okay, I'll write to when they're 5. I want to know, I can manage a 5-year, I want to know what about 15-year-old daughters, please. Please tell me about that. And what you find in many church plants, church plants begin to do this. They begin to face these same problems. They'll either grow medium and then they begin to think, what are we going to do as we get bigger? Or they bomb and die. Or some of them just do that and it's a long, slow death. So in effect, what you've planted is a medium-sized church that gets stuck. So whatever you do, you've got to teach your church planters about growth. Now, you could say we keep on planting and planting and planting and planting. I don't think you can sustain that over 40 or 50 years. Some, as you know, the big American church, they don't plant till they're thousands. You can go for the model that says let's plant when we're 120, get up to 120 and do it again. And then do it again, and then do it again, and do it again. I don't know anybody that's done that. That's what the literature says. We need somebody who's done that over 5 or 6 decades and told us what it felt like and how the church felt like it. Because you know, if you've done church planting, if you're in the group that goes out, it's exciting to start with. If you're in the group, you're the left behind. There is nothing worse than being the left behind group. Because you've just lost your best people. You've given all your best people. You're also probably committed financially. Our first church plant, we were paying for it for 5 more years. You know this, church plants, mother congregation, daughter congregation, becomes sister, and off she goes her own sweet way within about a year. So I'm not at all saying don't church plant. I mean, we've done it and it's very exciting. And there are places on earth, there are places in Britain that need a church plant. But some of the literature seems to me now is that it's all church planting as if, well, that's the way to do it. And I would say we at times we've had 3 preachers preaching to congregations of about 60 in the evening all pretty much doing the same kind of material. All of them have got projectors, pianists, halls. You know, they've spent a whole ton of money in running a meeting for about 50 people at night when they might as well have been together. And arguably, a larger church can finance outreach that smaller church plants. Small church plants tend to be friendship-based evangelism, inevitably. They can't afford a CAP centre. They can't afford an Iranian-speaking evangelist. A big group can. Sorry, you were going to say?
Yeah, I follow the force of what you're saying.
Yeah.
In practice, though, would it not be in the vast majority of cases, tends to and to go beyond the sort of perhaps church buildings, you need to spend the millions.
Yeah.
So you rightly raised the question of how long do people pay for a church for that. But actually, going through that barrier,
No, you're absolutely right. I talked to Chris Green at Oak Hill. We had a long chat about this. And he said, you know, Ray, the biggest problem in church growth in Britain, planning regulations. So that's the biggest gospel hindrance in the country. Now, we would think it's the hardness of people's hearts. It's the, you know, postmodern secular cultures. No, it's not. It's planning regulations. It's stuffing churches all up and down the country. So, yeah, I mean, his view is that there are two models, he feels, is that, you know, grow to 120 church plant and do it again, or the model that says, okay, let's just grow. He reckons that most churches with good leadership could grow to 1,000. But the biggest constraint is facilities. And the biggest problem there is, I said it's finance. It will be a mixture of finance, planning regulations. Some of you are in buildings, you're not allowed to touch them, you know, what do you do? Some larger church goes for the multiple service, you know, we have 9 o'clock, 11 o'clock, 4 o'clock, 7 o'clock, you know. And again, in America, I mean, where do you stop? I mean, Hybels now has this massive auditorium that seats 7,500 people, and he just has a Saturday evening and four Sundays. And, it's a headache, isn't it? Either way, you're right. Either way, you're going to spend money. Either way, it's a bit of a pain. Certainly the going smaller thing, you can often find halls to hire up to about 150 people. School halls are pretty good at that. Not many places have halls which you can hire for 1,000 people. You're right, it is
a...
Yeah. Yes, you could. I mean, that's one of those things, I guess, local wisdom would tell you. I must say, it's interesting that... a lot of the large charismatic church groupings now, that they have taken that bull by the horns, and they just go for factory units and do them up. And they say, look, it's very sellable. Once we fill it, we'll go and buy a bigger factory unit. Okay, external aesthetics are rubbish. Internal aesthetics aren't bad. And we have something to sell. That's that. They've gone down that route. I think partly because they tried the small church planting model in the 80s and 90s, and found what it turned out was that if it's very small, a la Crowded House, can I say that? A lot of those either bomb or they go kind of weird, introspective, heavy shepherding, don't reach many non-Christians. The ones that get successful, they soon get up to this. It doesn't, if you're successfully church planting, you can go from 30 to 120 in 3 or 4 years. You face this problem very quickly. I know of a church plant in Leicester, the Avenue, and it's great. Graham Biner led that. It's a brilliant church plant out of Knighton Evangelical Free Church. It's grown. The church now is at 120, and the leadership rate, we don't know what... Our vision was to church plant. What do we do now? And if you know Leicester, there's a southwest segment of Leicester that is, you know, Christian heaven on earth almost. You know, there are evangelical churches all over the place. But he said, we're finding it hard to church plant where the non-Christians live in North Leicester because none of our members live out there. We can't follow the same model. What are we going to do? I said, your problem. But that issue comes up sooner or later. You could go for, well, every time we get to 120, we go and get, you know, good pastor teacher and plant another church half a mile down the road. Could do that. Another issue, I must say, in the literature, is overseen, it's overlooked. It looks like church plants grow. They do. But they grow by attracting people. The numbers of converts, not as great as it looks like. So your church might go from 30 to 80. But the, you know, 40 of that 80 are fairly Christianized or already people already going to church, just wanted something different to do. I think you have to be honest and say, how many converts are you seeing? And let me tell you this, most converts today, if you talk about from first contact with the gospel to conversion, it's a 10-year story, at least 10-year story today. It may be longer than that. Four of our friends have become Christians. One of them got converted after about 7 or 8 years, two after 10 or 12, one was 22 years. And it was because she met my wife Jenny at antenatal class, and over 22 years we gospelized her, invited her, and eventually she became a Christian. 22 years. So if a church plant, you know, you've got to show some results pretty quickly. They aren't going to be converts. They're going to be Christianized people already going to fancy something different. So it may not be as much of a gospel thing as it looks. It could be, but the church would really, really, really have to have a passion for that, because it will just say, we've actually attracted a whole load of Christian people who like it, and now we're up to 100 and awkward sized already. What do we do? Oh, we've got to go and find a full-time pastor teacher, but we can hardly afford you, let alone go and find another one. So I'm not saying don't, but I'm saying it's not as simple as it looks. And I don't know of many. The chap who founded our church planted, he led our other two. So he was a fantastic church planter. But, you know, pretty much wore him out. Three church plants in an incredibly gifted man. And it's hard to find those men who can take it from 30 to 100 well. So I just think we need to work on that one. Can I move on? I don't want to sort of detract, but I've got a PowerPoint, haven't I? Yeah, I can't remember what it is. Okay, yeah, here he is. Going for growth. Here's some insights, I think. Let me get this out of your way. But I will come back to this in a minute. Have I got the buzzer? I have. Yeah, okay. You've lost it. Going for growth, Acts 16. This is pure Tim Keller. You know it, some of you, but others of you won't. Acts 16, growth tactics in detail. Growth tactics. Strategic. Take the gospel to places. Paul went to cities. He went to God-fearers, and you know all that. But tactically, Acts 16 is a phenomenal insight, isn't it? The gospel comes to Europe. How's it come to Europe? Well, you get a woman reached by word ministry. There are people reached coming along to a meeting. They hear the word. They believe it. What a convert she was. A dealer in purple cloth. What would the equivalent be that today? She's got her own Rolls-Royce Aston Martin dealership. She's rich. How do we know she's rich? Because she can come back to my house and my servants will look after you. She's rich. She's high caste import-export. You'd love a convert like her, wouldn't you? Just, you know, first sermon you ever preach, thump, there she is. All that I have is at the gospel's disposal. Brilliant. Well, there you are. She's reached by word ministry. But it's interesting, isn't it? Even there, the Lord opened her heart. It wasn't the brilliance of Paul. It wasn't his kind of fantastic missionary presentation skills. It was the Lord opened her heart. So we're just knocked down to size, aren't we? Whatever gifts we've got, we're just knocked down to size. Only God can open blind eyes. And God did that day. Well, that's an encouragement to us, isn't it? Whoever we are. We don't have to be the Apostle Paul. If God opens hearts, he can open anybody's hearts through word ministry. Brilliant. But then Luke introduces us to a slave girl. Now, she's reached by deed ministry. What do I mean by that? Well, she wasn't at a place of prayer. She is a slave in many, many ways. She's economically owned, dominated, and used and abused. She's also spiritually demon-possessed. She's a slave in many dimensions. And there are people like that today. We have a truancy officer at home. And I also truancy officers like spoil sports. You know, they nab kids off on the street, sort of bunking off on, you know, half an hour early from the last music lesson that you was bored in or something. She said, Ray, I try and track young teenage girls, because if I don't track them, a man is using them somewhere. Particularly immigrants, particularly East European girls. She said, most of my working career is to try and keep East European girls out of being slave to men. I said, you're joking. In my town? She said, in our town, Ray. That was a jaw-dropping moment. In my town, young East European girls are part of a slave trafficking system, and the truancy officer's doing her level best. Now, I don't meet girls like that. My wife doesn't. None of the women in the church do. You have to go and find them. and you have to go and help them. Now, we don't know. The woman was reached the first Lord's Day, Sabbath. After a period of time, Paul couldn't stand it any longer. Now, Paul knows this. If I break the bonds of a slavery, it will cost. Paul, it was cost him a severe beating. Now, I don't know if you've ever been beaten up. I had a few fist fights with my brother, but nothing serious. I've never been beaten up. Paul is severely beaten. He knows that's what's going to happen. As soon as these owners, wherever there is money involved, you know, why did it take Wilberforce so long to change the slave system? Because there was money at stake. There was a kind of, you know, vested interest. And when you challenge vested interests, it's going to cost you. If you're going to meet needy people, you're going to meet their practical needs. It's going to cost you. It might cost you money. It'll cost you energy. It'll bring you heartbreak and disappointment and fear and worry. Compare the woman reached by deed word ministry. Huge rewards. Great. Easy peasy. Wonderful. Love her. Fantastic. We need more like her. But you never reach slave girls like that. Slave girls are going to be reached. Are going to be costly and tough. And it was through that practical challenging of her economic and spiritual slavery. Now, Luke doesn't explicitly say, and she became a Christian. But I think that's the implication. We'll see in a moment why I think that. And then the third is a man. How's he reached? He's reached by life ministry, isn't he? He meets blokes and he's never met men like them before. Probably a middle-aged man, probably an ex-Roman legionary. We know he lives in a shame and honour culture. You remember that beginning of Gladiator when the Roman army goes to work? What do they say to one another as they get geared up to take on the Germanic hordes? They say, strength and honour. That's what they say. Strength and honour. Don't let the side down. I'd rather die than let the side down. That's why he's going to kill himself, isn't it? He's going to kill himself because of the shame of failing. He's a tough, rough man. He has dished out a beating. He'd have done that many a time. What did the Roman army do? Kill people efficiently. That's what the Roman army did. None of this Pax Romana stuff. They only did it because they killed enemies efficiently. That's where he comes from. That's his world. And he has failed. He's about to kill himself till a man says, "We're still here." You go, "What do you mean you're still here? Prisoners escape. If they can, no, we're not. We're still here. We're still here." And he's never seen anything like it. So tell me, what is it? What have I got to do? And isn't that interesting? That's the default mode of the human heart, isn't it? Religion. What have I got to do? What have I got to do? Well, you've got to do nothing. You've got to listen to a message of what's being done. And he becomes a Christian. It's a fantastic story. And he and his household, you know the stats on that. You go for children. It's American stats, but I don't know how clear that. Go for children. Children gets converted. Something like 4 or 5% chance that someone else from the family gets converted. Get the woman and you get about a 20% chance. Get the man and you have about an 80 to 90% chance of getting someone in the family. That's phenomenal, isn't it? Where did church put all their, where do we put our resources? Who do we go for? We go for the children. We should be going for men. Crazy. You know, most churches, what is the split? At best, 60-40. Male, female. I sometimes feel, you know, believe in election, you know. Do you believe in election? What kind of is it 60-40 male, female, Lord? You know, do the men lose out? No, of course not. God is saying, no, I love lost men as I love lost women and lost children. So Luke gives us this, and you know, Keller makes this fantastic point at the end of it, kind of really got me. What does a Jewish man get up every morning? He says, "I thank you, O God, you know, maker of heaven and earth, that you did not make me a woman, a slave, or a Gentile." That's what you thank God for. Like, I'm none of those things. And the gospel, well, you know the Carlsberg's advert, you know, the gospel reaches parts that other gospels can't reach. And Luke is saying, see, God can reach the unreachable. And he does it through the gospel. But he does it in different ways. All of them involve the word. Of course they do. All of them involve hearing him. If you don't hear, you can't get saved. You can't watch somebody and become a Christian. You need to hear a message. Christianity is a message. It is not a lifestyle. It's a message. You've got to hear it. But you hear it in different contexts, different ways. And if you put all your eggs in one method only, you will only reap one type. So at home, we've worked at a little kind of mental map. I don't know what you Rick Warren's purpose-driven church. I don't get the baseball diamond thing. Don't play baseball, don't really understand baseball, love sport, but don't get baseball. But the thing that worried me about his baseball diamond is that it's progressive. You become a Christian, then you learn to be discipled, then you become somebody, and then eventually you start telling people about Jesus. And that's about a 10-year program. Like, you become a Christian this week, go and tell somebody this week. You know, it's like, what? Oh. It seems to me that much more than a sort of following your way around a program, that Christianity is like being on a rack. And you are stretched till it hurts in different directions at the same time. Even men have to multitask. What do they have to do? Well, they have to grow to maturity. You want everybody to keep growing up into Christ. But at the same time, you want people to grow down by serving, to get on their knees, put a towel on their arm and serve. Every Christian. You don't say, well, when you've grown for 10 years, you know, then start getting involved in the life. No, you want everybody. Everybody is a servant. We're following a servant king. But also, we want everybody to reach out into mission. We want everybody to grow up, grow down, and grow out at the same time. So evangelism is not an optional extra for the really keen ones who've got ability to nab strangers in the street and insult them. That's not what we're waiting for, is it? We want everybody. So we've used this mental map to say, where are our resources going? And are we doing all these three things well? Are we helping people to grow? Are we helping people to serve? Are we helping people to reach out? And it seems to me it's both a, if I can put it like this, a I think I've got a stronger side. Yes, a bottom up. We want every individual to own those three things. Nobody opts out of them. Everybody owns them. We teach that as a Christian, you are committed. You commit to. I want to become more like Jesus, serve my brothers and sisters, and be part of the good news to other people. But also, it needs a bit of top down planning. As a leadership, how do we facilitate growing up? How do we facilitate serving? How do we facilitate reaching out? Now for us, how would I put? Yeah. Encouraging maturity, large, small and specialist. What do I mean by that? Well, most churches, Sunday is your large meeting. But the key is this. If you ever want to grow large, you have to grow small. You never grow large without growing small. Even Acts 2, what did they do? They met in the temple courts and they met house to house. Large and small. There it is, Acts 2. Furniture. Now, I know there's not a huge ton of stuff said about house groups and Bible study groups and all the rest of it in the Bible. But large and small is a kind of how we help deliver maturity. The small keeps the relational accountability. The large, the wow factor. And when you're bringing your mates, it's great to bring them and go, wow, a lot of people here today. I didn't know this people came. Is Christianity that popular? I thought they were all dead, all you Christians. I know. Wow. Well, that's the large. The small. And the large, it is something about great Bible teaching to a whole load of people, isn't it? There's something fantastic about that. There is something about singing, Guide Me, O Thou Great Redeemer, or whatever your favourite is, you know, Church Arise. When you sing, O Church Arise, with 500 people, I mean, your heart is pumping. You sing it with a girl on the violin, it's hard, you know. Okay, so large, small, and we talk about specialists. Yes, there will be need for specialist help. We've already talked about training leaders, but you might have. We had an evening once for parents of teenage kids. Fantastic evening. We just talked to them about some of the pain, the pressure, the difficulties their kids and they are facing. You can do that. Some specialist help. You might have a Greek class. You might have, you know, all kinds of things. You can't do everything in your large and small. You might need some specialists. Then ministry, empower, there's that word again. We work very hard at teams. We do everything we do as a team. That's the big engineering, the re-engineering that has to happen. You go from keen volunteers to everything done as teams. That is the key change between an awkward, well, a medium to a large, in between an awkward. You have to engineer around teams, Act 6. Teams, where you empower people And then all of a sudden you realise, ah, to do that, I need to train leaders. So leaders, top leaders, have to train loads of leaders. Instead of being the pastor to everybody, you say, I have to move my workload from pastoring everybody to actually training leaders. It's the Jethro thing. It's the Jethro thing. I said a few minutes ago to a friend, Jethro, fantastic insight this, isn't it? Where does it come? It comes when God has given lots of prescriptive detail about the worship of the temple and the tribes. And it's really important. The detail, you break these rules, Nadab and Abihu. You muck about with these rules and you die. So it's in that, you know, if you guys like the regulative principle, there it is, you know, this poof. But right in the middle of all that, comes a non-covenant community member who says, do you know what, Moses, you need to get smart, organize better. What God is saying is that, yes, there is detail, there is, you know, sufficient scripture, but the scripture sufficiently teaches insights of common grace. There are people out there, not Christian, who have insights of common grace. Who was it? Chip and Dan Heath. Yes, I know. You won't forget their name, will you? Which parents were cool? The son, Chip and Dan. Well, there you go. Chip and Dan Heath. Well, you call them Chip and Pin. Yeah. Chip and Pin. Yeah. Chip and Dan Heath, written a brilliant book on how do you motivate change. And it's not Christian, but it's got some very wise insights. Rudy Giuliani, great insights on leadership. One of his key ones is this. Remember this? Weddings optional, funerals mandatory. Never miss funerals of friends. If you can't make their daughter's wedding, they'll say, oh, that's a shame, but thanks, Ray. You missed their daughter's funeral, never forget. What an insight from leadership that is. Shackleton, keep your friends close, keep your enemies even closer. Which tent did Shackleton sleep in? He slept in the tent of the most three cantankerous people. Because he thought, if I can't keep these guys on board, we're all going to die. So I got to keep him with these guys so that we all get safely. As you know, and he made that great epic journey in the Antarctic. So, insights from common grace. Teams, leaders. We use a thing called CARE. Walter Wright, Relational Leadership, an older book now, maybe written 20 years ago. Phenomenal insights into how you keep teams on board. Very, very helpful. Walter Wright used to be Dean of Regent College. Very, very helpful. And SHAPE, I use, everything you hear today is regurgitated somebody else, okay? So,
does CARE stand for something?
CARE stands for, okay, clarify the mission. Every team needs to know what is our mission, agree on our goals, review our progress, equip our people. So every team needs to say, well, you know, a guy was asked, janitor, clean toilets, what do you do for a living? I'm part of the team that puts a man on the moon. He was a janitor. He was a toilet cleaner at NASA. Now, somebody's done a great job. When the toilet cleaner says, I'm part of the team that puts a man on the moon, that is what we mean. So the guys that press the button, we're part of the team that enables people to hear about Jesus. We're part of the team that puts people in heaven. Everybody in your church needs that mission feel, doesn't it? I'm part of the team that puts people in heaven. That's what you want. Oh, I press the button. Oh, I just, you know, I make the coffee. No, I'm part of the team that puts people into eternity with God, right? That's fantastic. That's mission. Agree on your goals. Get people to talk about specifics. How are we going to achieve our goals? Something that Christians aren't very good at doing. Some of you who've been through the whole Cornhill or any other training will know the whole kind of review thing. You know, the crits and people feeding back and, you know, your boss telling you, oh, sorry, you know, that was rubbish, Ray. But reviewing progress is something every Christian needs to be part of. Because it's in reviewing progress. How do we do what we do better? Not who's to blame, but how could we do what we do better? And Christians aren't very good at that. We do the same old thing in the same old way. We get the same old results. But why don't we review and equip people? What do we need? Do we need kit? Do we need a training course? Do we need a bit of motivation? Team leaders need to have a thing like that in their brain all the time. So when they meet, it's not just gassing around and talking. The CARE program is what Walter Wright recommends. We've used it. It's brilliant. I've loved it. It always helps. Just keeps a team shaped well and keeping its eye on the ball. And SHAPE, as you know, is Rick Warren's thing about individual, where do I fit? But this one is something that we've tried to translate Acts 16 into practice. We have three evangelistic things we try and promote. We prepare people for going and telling their faith. If you had 2 minutes to share how you become a Christian, could you do it? could you do it if I had two electrodes on you and a buzzer? And if you used a word I don't understand, I'd zap you. I bet most of the room would be twitching. Because as soon as we start telling our story, we lapse into subcultural jargon. And people kind of, they don't understand some of it. They don't understand a ton of Christian words anymore. Let alone the old favourites of the blood of the Lamb of God and all that sort of stuff. I don't get that anyway. But, you know, people aren't good. Now, if you say, well, they hear me preach, I kind of example. No, you've got to get them doing it. What was Jesus' method of teaching? I tell you, you tell me. And as I hear you tell me back, I know whether you know. Who is the Son of Man? What do the people say? Who do you say I am? Does Jesus have a kind of identity crisis at that moment? I'm not sure who I am at the moment. No, he's saying that I know. Do you know? Put it in your own words. Now, when most Christians tell their testimony, I've heard loads of Christian testimonies. They go on and on and on. Well, it was in 1953. Oh, no, I'm already yawning. You've got 2 minutes. Could you share your Christian story in 2 minutes? Because most Christians don't get 2 hours. They don't even get half a couple of minutes. Well, you go to church. Why do you go to church? Let me tell you my story. Do you prepare people for that? Do you tell? Could your church do the bridge diagram, for example? Could it? Classic one is this: religions. We live in a world of multiple religions. Easy one. This is an easy. You could do this in 10 seconds. How do you spell religion? D-O. That's it. You don't need to know anything about Islam, Buddhism, you know, transcendental meditation. Everything is spelled D-O. It's about what you do. How do you spell Christianity? D-O-N-E. Now, you see all these people, I don't know what, I wouldn't want to know about Islam. You don't need to know anything about Islam. You just need to have religion is spelled D-O. And Christianity is spelled D-O-N-E. And the numbers of Christians go, oh, I could do that. Yeah, you could do that. That's what I'm doing. I'm training you to help people understand the difference. Now, that isn't the whole thing. There's loads more to say. But that isn't easy, isn't it? And there's things like you could do to train people to share their faith. A lot of people feel very negative, don't they, about sharing their faith. We tend to think that the problem is they're afraid, and it is. But we're not often giving them simple tools to use to overcome their fears. And some of those very simple gospel presentations. Now, I know it's no good teaching it as one size fits all. I know that. So you need a variety, don't you? So we do that. We do quite a lot of that. And most Christians, not very good at it, actually. Now, let me ask you, how many hours training did you get before you were let loose in a car on your own? Don't know, probably, did you have any driving lessons? 25, 30, 40, some of you? 100? But you got some training before the government would let you go out on the road and kill somebody, potentially. People's eternity is at stake, isn't it? Humanly speaking, I know God's got his elect and God's sovereign and all that, but why would God let his children loose on a desperately needy world where eternity hangs on this without any training whatsoever, without even practicing sharing your faith? How would you answer this question? Could you explain the cross simply without using words like substitutionary atonement, propitiation? Could you explain the cross? Well, this is basically, a bloke told me this, an old man, he listened to me, said, is it like this, right? Did Jesus take the blame? I thought, yes, Jesus took the blame. It's basically what the cross is about. Jesus took the blame. That's simple English. That's okay. First time round, you might come back again and again and again, but basically that'll be okay. Do you tell, if you have somebody explain the cross, basically it's like this, Jesus took the blame. Have you done that? Because if you haven't, there are people out there who think, oh, if only I had more courage. But actually, a little bit of help might help them a long way. Second thing we do is provide for come and see. I just quote some of the statistics to a group. Dave Bennett found when he interviewed hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of adults, had they become Christians, they said, having my questions answered, only 10% thought that was important. Being invited to something by somebody I knew, 90%. I think it was 92% people said that was significant in me becoming a Christian. This is the interesting one. So I quote to these other groups. People said, even when I said no to an invite, I appreciated being asked. For me, a huge, I thought, my goodness, do you know, I have a whole church full of Christians who don't ask people because they say they'll say no. So I don't ask them because I don't want to put them off. Dave Bennett's research found this. If you ask them and they say no, they still say, thank you for asking me. That it's a no is still a gospel win. A yes is fantastic, but a no is fantastic because they say, thank you for asking me. It's very kind of you. They don't hate you. They don't feel you're trying to sell them anything. They just think, thank you very much for asking me. So the problem is in the heads of the Christians, and you have got to knock it out of their heads. Say, you can invite them. Now, use your wisdom. We invite my mates. I invite them golf day. I invite my mates paintballing. They love getting me in the head with a paintball. It's just great fun. I got Ray in the head with a paintball. You know, he bought me a pint of beer afterwards. He must be okay. Now, 10 years later, that same bloke might say, can I come to your church? Or I ask, do you like coming to church, Christmas carol service? We were saying, you know, Christmas carol services, every Christian in the country would know at least 10 people they could ask. Easy peasy. Because you don't need to forget the word friendship evangelism. Get rid of that word friendship evangelism. Because people think they've got to be so close. We've known each other 25 years. I went to his wedding. He went to my wedding. We've give each other. Look, it's acquaintanceship at best. Just recognition. I'm Ray from down the road, you know. We've got a church carol, so we'd like to come. It's great fun. You've got to use wisdom. A whole load of girls doing a punting trip to Cambridge in the rain tomorrow. But all they've done is invite their friend to a friendship builder. Later on, they'll invite their friends to something with a taster talk. Later on, it might be an invite to a carol service or a Christianity Explored. Some people you can invite straight to church. You've got to use wisdom. But creating an invite culture amongst your church and teaching them that a no is not a failure. A no is a success. Don't let your church members say no for the people out there. Even if they got loads of no's, it still says your church counts. Your church cares. Brilliant. And that is a big thing. Now, that takes time to create a culture like that. And you've got to model it yourself. Many vicars, ministers, pastors say, how many non-Christians you genuinely have asked yourself as your friends? Zero. I don't do that kind of thing. A friend of mine, Tim, he works in outreach ministry in Nottingham. He said, you know, we did a sports quiz. And the church I was working with, the vicar, he played for the local tennis club. I thought, brilliant, brilliant. He said, Richard, how many are you asking? He said, oh no, I'm not asking any. He said, I separate work from pleasure. The tennis club is what I do in my leisure. I wouldn't even dream of. And he couldn't believe it, that the vicar didn't even think that the people he played tennis with would, he wouldn't even think of inviting them to anything. Well, if that's what you model, then it's not surprising the church struggles, is it? So you have to intentionally go out there and do something. You know, join the Model Railway Club if you, like me, a bit of an anorak. Or I play hockey. Do you still play hockey, Phil? Yeah, see, we play hockey. I play in an old man's team. We lose every week. You know, I won't tell you our worst score, 16-0. It was terrible. But I meet a bunch of mates, and they are not my members' friends or acquaintances. They're mine. And I know how hard it is to get ordinary people along to things, because they all say no, 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 no in the dressing room and laugh sometimes. But one or two of them behind the scenes say, Ray, can I talk to you about my marriage? Can I talk to you about God? Got to model it. Final thing, promote care and serve. So you can teach people to tell. You can encourage them to bring. And you run a whole range. And you probably do all that already. But you know, you just still need to get people to keep investing in friendships and acquaintances and doing things with non-Christians and not seeing them as projects, but genuinely loving them. And then promote care and serve. Do good to all people, especially the household of faith. Doing good to people, whether they convert or not. It's no good saying, well, I'll only do this to you while, you know, if you're really interested in Christianity. It's a good thing to meet people's practical needs. Now, what your church could do, I don't know. I said to you in Bedford, a huge NFI church does a fantastic work with homeless people. Other churches work with street prostitutes. Other churches work with neglected elderly. You know, you could do something to meet some practical needs, because as you minister like that, you will meet people you would never meet through invites and stuff. The slave girls, and they'll bring their own problems. They won't bring a ton of money, they'll bring a ton of problems, but isn't it exciting? Got one at the moment called Donna. You've never seen so many tattoos, and that's on the parts of the body I can see. You know, I mean, she's got rings and You know, if she had a if you had a magnet, goodness me, she'd. Do you know what I mean? And she's coming, and she's and you know you see her, and you go. I mean, she just honestly, you go. But her heart, she's very sensitive to spiritual things. Now we've met her through doing a work with vulnerable women that our women workers do. I'd never have met a donor in my life. I'd have never thought a donor could get saved. She's not there yet, but she's very sensitive. Mother of so many children, I've lost count with by different blokes. And but wouldn't it be wonderful if you met her in heaven and go, oh, isn't God good? But people like that are reached through intentional, deliberate acts of compassion. And it's slow. It's very slow. You know, it's no good saying, we'll help you if. It's like, we'll help you because it's a good thing to do. Now, you can't do everything. You can't meet all the needs of a community. We could meet some. And those three strategies are our way of trying to translate, you know, Lydia, the slave girl, and the jailer. That's what we've worked at. It's a kind of mental map we've used. Right, final bit. I think we're out of slides now. Yes, we are. Here we go. Back to this thing. Okay, a little bit already about this. You asked me about this growth curve again. This is Philip Jensen, but he's actually got it off somebody else called Aubrey Malthus, and he actually got it. This whole thing is the man who pioneered this is a guy called Torsten Hagerstrand, who did a thing called the diffusion of innovations in the 1950s. How do new things spread? What are some of the patterns you see? And when you see this church growth curve, Malthus and Jensen argue, actually, it looks nice and smooth. Oh, yeah, thanks. You just take that away. That's fine. Thank you. Sorry. This looks nice and smooth, doesn't it? But it's not. If you kind of went in detail. Yeah, that's fine. If you go in detail, in here, you find actually that is made up of the church could have done that. Or it could have gone, you know, over here. It began to platter. And this is really frustrating. This is a past that drives you nuts. When people, you've done all this growth and then they're happy. You know, they're, oh, it's nice now. We've got through the small church. We're now medium. And now we're through the awkward size. We're now large. And some of you guys are really dumb at heading today. You think, you know, there's a real problem at 800. I go, oh, is there really? Oh, no. I didn't know that. Do you mean I have to keep on tackling these things if we ever get that big? But just when people feel happy, it's the plateau. And you're not very far away from, ah! That's like Blackpool, isn't it? You know, that big thing up at ah! And that's frustrating because just here, that's everybody's happy then. And it's at just that point there, when instead of doing that, you have to kind of make a courageous gospel decision to do something different. A courageous thing here that this church didn't die or plateau and go down. Because here, somebody made a courageous gospel. It's made up of a little S curve. This big curve is made of lots of, and as it, when it went there, it made another courageous gospel decision. And then another one. And then another one. So what it means is the whole of your church leadership life, you are having to make courageous gospel decisions. And they will take different shapes. For you, it might be a courageous decision to church plant. And you go, we can't lose the 30 or 40 or 50 or whatever of our best people and raise a whole load of money. And you find God's people rise to the challenge. And you gave a whole load of best people away and God sent a whole load of new people in and they've all, and more people are on board and the money came from someone. You go, brilliant, isn't that incredible? So it's not about our church necessarily, it's about the church, the kingdom growing. Or it could be, we haven't got the money, but we desperately need to fund a youth worker, or we desperately need to fund a women worker. Or folks, can we dig deep? Come on. For us, I told you a few years ago, we made a courageous decision to go to 2 morning services. At the moment, it's paid off. All the way along our lives, we're having to do things that get ourselves out our comfort zone for the sake of the gospel. Remember what Driscoll said? You either hold on to these things and get angry and grieve when you lose them, or you see them as an opportunity to share these things with others for the sake of Jesus and the gospel. Now, you know this. I'm not teaching you anything you don't know, but that idea, you must keep the gospel right at the forefront. And you know, in church life, it's number one priority, but it just slips down the list. And you have to keep on pushing it back up there. All the time, you have to keep pushing it back up there. Because meanwhile, life, events, urgent takes over. You go, hold on a minute. And that's why I found that mental map helpful for me. It's like, where am I putting my resources? And the one that tends to get neglected, because the church members never thank you for spending time with non-church members, do they? They don't. They haven't come to see me, Ray. I thought you were my friend. I'm not just a church. Am I just a church member to you now? You used to be really close to me. You used to come and see us and pray with us. And now I know I get another one of the pastors come, but it's not you. Don't you love me anymore? Oh, you know all that sort of stuff. Oh. And it's heartbreaking. And you go, but I'm spending time with people who at the moment aren't going to be in heaven. You know, don't you think I should be doing that? Don't you think a lot of our staff resources ought to be involved with people? You know, at the end of the day, we try and organize some help through our home groups. And yeah, you will get a visit from one of the pastors at least once a year. But, you know, and that's tough. But that's a courageous gospel decision. And in one sense, that's the only way you stop a church plateauing and declining, is to make courageous gospel decisions. It might be the, you know what, folks, we have to go and find a big building. It might be we need to go and find some workers. It might be we need to go and give away, you know, a third of our congregation. There's no prescriptive, this is what it is. It's between you, the Lord, and the church to say, what is it for us? But I tell you what, if you don't make courageous gospel decisions, you will plateau, and that'll be great for a while. And then you go down. And then to try and make a courageous gospel decision when the speed is downhill fast, to do that is quite hard. It's very hard, actually. It can be done. You sometimes see a church that was once 500 down to 50 go back up again, but it's tough. So sooner or later, we're going to be faced with a courageous gospel decision. You say, what is it for you? What is it for you? New service? New work? I mean, you know, it's no good saying this is it, because it isn't. This is it. It's just that it will happen. So S-curves. What's the next one we got in there? People. Yeah. Okay. How do you motivate a church to grow? Please don't talk about numbers. Don't talk about numbers. Lady came to me. I said, Tina, would you like our church to be 1,000 people? Oh, no, Ray. I said, Tina, that's your husband and your son and your daughter. Oh, I'd love that. I said, that's all it is. That's what it is. If our church grew to 1,000, that's 3 more people sitting next to you. 3 people who you love. Your husband, your son, would you love that? I'd love that. So that's all we're talking about for the rest of the church too. Sometimes we've done a thing like this. There's all kinds of ways you've got to motivate people with people, rather than ideas and plans and schemes and agendas. And it's people, isn't it? One of our elders quite brilliantly said, we were passing the bread and the wine around. He said, look, as you take this bread, pray to God for the person who you would love to pass that bread to, who's not here now. Wow, the whole church was in tears. I prayed for my mum. She's 79. I'm going to see her in a minute. Who on earth would I love to see next to me? My mum. And the whole church did that. And now that's what motivates people. Like, is that? And that's all we're talking about, people. Is just talk about my mum, my son, my daughter-in-law. We've all got them, haven't we? So it's no good talking about, oh, we want our church to get to 1,000. We just want our mum next to me. And that's always... And that's the biggest motivation of all, isn't it? So when you see people who are saved, we recently had one of our deacons. He was converted when I first went to the church in 78. His 78-year-old mum became a Christian. And the whole church sang because it gave us all hope. She has had a 30-plus year conversion story. He has been praying for his mum. We've been praying for him for 30 years, and she became a Christian, got baptized, a 78-year-old earlier this year. Brilliant. Now, that motivates people, doesn't it? So all we're talking about is more people like her. Do you want that? Have you got a mum who's not converted? Yeah, I have. Well, if Chris Armand's mum can get converted, why God couldn't save your mum? That's the kind of thing we have to do heaps. Andy Stanley, North Point Church in Carolina somewhere, huge, one of the American beggar churches. He said, you know what we do now? We make a lot of people's confirmations, baptisms. He said, we rather than get up at the front and get them to tell their story, because in a big group, you know, you can't hear and see too well. He said, we put a lot of resources in videoing it well. And we get them in a quiet studio and we get them to tell their story, and we script it well, and we talk it through, and we rehearse it and we show it. And he said, the impact is enormous, because people see this person telling their story from their heart. We've got to that's what we call celebrating a win. Celebrate your wins. That's one way of doing it. So we don't talk about church growth. We talk about people getting saved and celebrating that. And of course you do too. But that's nothing that motivates people like that. Last bit. Okay, just a little bit of, again, oh, you go, I hate this thing, Ray. What are you talking about? Okay, this is another insight. Decision making. Got to work this one out, okay? An innovation like a mobile phone has a typical kind of uptake, saturate the market, decline type thing. Okay, it's called the, this curve is a, this could be a measles epidemic. My PhD supervisor is one of the world's leading writers on how epidemics spread. You know, this is on measles in Iceland. You know, a few people get it, then more and more and more, just because of the way networks work and so on. Okay, this is a very common statistical average thing. Some things get taken up quicker and peak faster and so on, but this bell-shaped curve is very typical. Now, what you find is this. In a normal population, you'll always have about 1% of people who will innovate anything. You know, they'll have the latest gizmos, they'll buy anything new, they just love new things. 1%. They are idiots. They innovate anything. They would have been the people who went along, you know, bought a Clive Sinclair C5. So you don't remember that? They would have got one of those, you know, death trap on wheels. But they got one because they love new, they like to be at the cutting edge. They're dangerous people. At the other end of the spectrum, there will always be 1% of people who are the honourable opposition. Jesus is coming again. Votes for, votes against. Votes against. Okay. They will be against anything you want to do because there is 1% of people wired to innovate anything. And there's about 1% of people wired to be against anything. I got a bloke I know who said, I'm not going to learn to drive. Why should I? I'm not going to have a mobile phone. Why should I? I don't want to live in the 20th century, let alone the 21st. See, he's just one of those kind of awkward people. But 1% like that. Okay, now these people are slightly aberrant. They're kind of, you know, there they are. There are Christian cranks and they're both ends of the spectrum. Okay, now that's not the problem. Although these people can be, and I'll tell you about that in a moment. But then, here and here, these are interesting people. These are really key people. There's about 15% of people or so who are open to sensible change, positive people, people who like new things, give it a try. There are 15% of people who are pretty negative about most things, pretty cautious, pretty no, 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 no. They won't innovate. They won't have a mobile phone till nearly everybody else has got a mobile phone. They won't get a plasma. They won't get a flat screen TV. You know, until they wouldn't have changed from analog to digital until they absolutely had to, till the screen went blank and, you know, and all that sort of stuff. Okay, these are negative people. They're just that. Now, this would be true about anything. This isn't Christianity. This is just anything. In a normal population, you have very, very positive, quite negative, very negative. And then in the middle, this lot. So what are we left with? 1, 15, 1, 15, so 32. You've got about 70% of people somewhere in the middle who are, they would like to say we're balanced, you know, that we're kind of in the middle there somewhere. Most of us like to be there, don't we? You know, you're extreme, I'm balanced, they're a nutcase. That's kind of, you know, how that's where most people are, aren't they? You know, she's very right wing, you know, I'm quite balanced, they're very... That's where most people are. Now, these people, interestingly, they are kind of Mr. Face both ways. Mm-hmm. They kind of look and look. They look and look. Now, if you can get these people, these key people on your side, these people go, oh, okay. Don't get these people on your side, the nutcase, okay? Because these people look, and they're terrorists. Oh, no, 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 no. Don't do what he wants because he'll take us anywhere. You know, he'll want us waving flags next week, and next week, you know, we'll have to clap our hands and, oh, no, he's a threat. But these people go, you know, this is quite sensible. I agree with the pastor. I agree with the vicar. I think it's a good idea. And these people go, okay, okay. And these people go, oh, do we have to? Okay. If these people get a voice, okay, these awkward people, these people follow them. So if you have a key deacon who's over here somewhere, these people will listen to him. And then you set up this kind of conflict thing. Now, this is a bit of a narrow thing. This is a free church moment. Is that okay, guys? If you're not in free church moment. Free churches are rubbish at this. They have a voting procedure, okay? They have misunderstood the way the New Testament teaches congregational church order big time. Okay, so what do they do? Say, well, every member has a vote. Now, just think of the maths. Who runs the church? The 16% who are negative run the church, because votes have a kind of threshold, don't you? You need, I don't know, what is it for a pastor? Most churches have something around 80%. These people are going to be against most things. They only need to persuade 3 or 4% of others, and every vote is lost. So what it means is the negative runs the church. By just being, they don't have to do it, they have to be negative, they run the church. To get that many people on your side is tough in a voting procedure, especially if these people have been there a long time and have a bit of a say. So the whole voting procedure to me seems like just common sense nightmare. It's extremely hard to get a high vote thing. So we don't vote in our free church. We're Presbyterians with a small p. What we do, we say the leaders lead the church through the scripture, and they have to lead change through fair use of scriptural arguments. Your consent is assumed unless you can prove otherwise. If you dissent, you can dissent, but it's got to be on scriptural grounds. Just like the elders must lead scripturally, you can dissent if you can show a scriptural reason why to. But that's it. So if we have a vote, is anybody against? That's what we ask for. Is anybody against on what scriptural grounds? And we have got that down so that we have very, very few votes anyway, because most of it's consensual and tacit. And when we do have some votes, it helps bring it back to the Bible. Brings it back to the Bible. So somebody says, look, you put this name forward of this man, I know he tells lies. One person knowing that from the scripture, that's it. It decides the issue, doesn't it? Because the Bible wins. It's not about votes, it's about what the Bible teaches. And somebody says, I know this man tells lies. It says here in the Bible he's got a man of integrity. He's not a man of integrity. One person knowing that, end of story. So in that sense, the Lord Jesus rules through the word. It just happens to be the leaders aren't leaders because they got, you know, I'm colonel or anything. It's just that I teach the word. And if I teach the word faithfully, fair enough. And if I don't, you have every right to say, look, Ray, that doesn't mean that, does it? Now, at the end of the day, we might have to disagree and so on and so forth. But this whole idea of the congregational vote, crazy, really, seems to me. Because it just doesn't understand how human nature's wired. Second thing it also teaches us, if you want to change things, you put all your resources into those people. These people should be your home group leaders. These people should be your team leaders. These people are the people that affect others. They have influence. You know what it says? If you want power, give it away. If you want power, give it away. You then gain influence. If you empower these people, kind of, you know, the mature, sensible, open to change, recognize it's not easy, but that's how it is. These people will then influence these people, and these people will influence these people, and you'll always have the 1% who's in that case, but they can't do much about that. But you've then taken most people with you consensually, because these people will go with the majority if the majority go with these people. So now what do we do as pastors? These people can shout loud. So we spend a lot of time trying to influence them because they can do a lot of damage. We ought to be spending a lot of time influencing these people because they can do a lot of good. So if we get these people on our side, so if you've got any major change, work on these people first, get them on board. They will influence these people. Then you may have to deal with some of these people personally. But please, please, please don't ask these people. The answer will always be no, Pastor. They'll be against it. These people say if it's sensible, well-reasoned, biblically argued, gospel challenging, we're up for it, Ray. And then the whole church goes. So it's just an insight. You may think it's, you know, but that has been something that's been found out in tons of studies right across all kinds of disciplines. It's just the way it is. And I found that when I found that out, I thought, oh, as a minister, I have spent a lot of time with the awkward people in my congregation trying to win them over. But actually, I should have spent more time with the people that influence other people for good. Interesting, isn't it? The Lord Jesus invested an enormous amount of time in a very few number of people, really, relatively, didn't he? But he trained them to train others. You know, what you've heard from me, pass on to reliable men who will pass on others. And one of the difficulties of a busy pastor, isn't it, is that we are fighting so many fires that we don't train enough firemen. And sometimes you have to step back and say, I'm going to have to do less part. I'm going to have to tell my congregation I've got to do less this or less that so I can spend more on this and more on that. That's part of what it means to help a church change and grow. OK, we're over time. Sorry to rabbit on. Well, that's, you know, things for you to have a think about anyway.